comments. Is there an interest in death itself, what death is, where it comes from, why it happens? Okay. Say again?
I said, what happens after?
What happens after, exactly. I think we're a little loud. It sounds a little loud to me. I'm practically whispering and I'm echoing in my own ears. Okay, let's start with just a moment of quiet. Just gather ourselves. This is a particularly close to the heart subject for some of us. So we really want to be as deeply centered in our own being as we can be, and as deeply connected in an upward manner to that power of spirit coming in as we can be. Also, this being again so personal, there's an element here of group attunement, where each of us puts into the center of the room, whether it's a conscious question or a conscious need, or just the simple fact that I'm here, what is it that I can learn? I want to ask the power of spirit to guide each one of us, to be receptive, to be inspired, and to be at least in some small way transformed. Progress through suffering, progress on the spiritual path happens one step at a time. So we also need patience with ourselves and with life. Om peace. Amen. All right. I think I'm going to start. I am a person who understands the small things by understanding it from a big perspective. That's not how everyone works, but it works the best for me, so I'm going to share that with you. I feel like if I can get an idea of why we're here and what we're doing, then it gives you a way to sort of face into each of those small events because you have the bigger picture. It's the small events overwhelm us when they intrude so close on our face that we can't see anything else. All of us live on this planet together, and we all have extremely similar experiences in certain ways. Before the program started, Santosh and I were talking about two things that happened this past weekend. One is a young couple got married, and I mean, within the context of our Ananda community, a young couple got married and a baby was born among our close friends. So there's this little tiny, tiny little body now that has this spirit that's going to have to go and do his whole who knows what incarnation. The wedding was for a young man who was born within the Ananda community, and so I've known him since before he was born, is how I say it. But I have promised him that I would not refer to his childhood anymore. He's a grown man, and he's ready to just be a grown man. But I've known him all growing up, and now he's married. You know, all of these different, I can see that some of you are, the phrase I use now is chronologically developed, to the point where you have had these kind of life experiences. Other people are chronologically challenged, the poor dears. But those of us who are chronologically developed, we've had these long cycles where we understand how that which looks like it's going to last doesn't shift. Even if it's not shifting tragically or catastrophically, it still just shifts. There it is. This little baby, once he's launched, he will not remain a baby. He will simply grow, presuming his life continues into something resembling a natural span. But nothing can stop it now. There's this inexorable feeling about it. And all of us have been through our own childhood, maybe through the childhood of our children. We've all just seen this endless force that we don't really even know where it comes from. It's just there. I swim at the YMCA, and I've been riding my bicycle to the Y on Ross Road over here. And if I time it just exactly wrongly, I hit all of the people going into school, and it, you know, can take me 15 minutes to just get through this. All of these children and all of their parents, and just this, for me, this, there's something very poignant about all of that. All the eager expectations, all the affection of the parents, all the children and all they're trying to do, it's, I don't really like to have to ride my bike through all that emotion every day, even though it's positive emotion. I prefer not to meet it if I can avoid it, just because there's a lot of, I'm involved with a lot of people in my life, so I don't need to go seek out total strangers to also be engaged with. But what I'm really talking about is what we all feel, which is, whatever you call it, there's this rhythm, isn't there? And there's, it's not just a physical rhythm. It's not just that bodies change and bodies grow old and bodies wear out and pass away or anything like that. But there's something deeper than that. It's just a compelling force, isn't it? I was with my, I have no children of my own. I've never been pregnant. And I was with a friend when his son, his daughter was born. And the baby had very slight bronchial distress, but enough that they took the baby away, and it was in a hospital, so they took him, her, back somewhere. And the father followed the baby, and I went, I followed the father. And so the child is there, maybe 90 seconds old at this point, or, you know, a minute, maybe 5 minutes. Immediately, the little girl is reaching up and taking her father's hand, just like that. There's an amazing picture that someone sent me, appears on the internet, when some surgeon did some surgery in utero, and just some major thing in the child had to be fixed, but the doctor just opened up the womb, fixed it, and then closed it up, and then the baby went to term and was born strong. There's a point at which that tiny baby's hand from inside the womb comes up and holds the surgeon's finger like that. And someone actually has a picture of it. So you see this, you can probably look it up. You see the sort of bulging tummy and all the, and then this tiny little hand coming up. Incredible. I mean, part of you thinks that the baby is thanking the doctor because this made all the difference in this individual's life. Wow, I know.
Actually, the doctor comments that it just shocked him, that it was...
That's right.
Like he couldn't stop crying or
something. Yeah. Because the doctor, right, the doctor's there, you know, the surgeons steel themselves a little bit so they're not thinking about really what they're doing. They're concentrated on whatever they're doing. And then all of a sudden this person reaches out. See, normally people are asleep when he's operating on them. I mean, I don't know what the whole reality of that was. But in any case, I mean, that alone, and it, all of us, we feel it. You know, there's just this force, isn't there? So what is that? When you can look to science for an explanation of it, you can look to psychology. You came to hear me, so I have to talk to you about it from the point of view of spirit, because God and divine realities are the entire reality that I've lived for since I was 19, when I was fortunate enough to encounter a spiritual teaching that absolutely resonated with me, and I've really done nothing else with my life but that. As I say, I'm quite well educated in a very narrow area, but I know a lot about this. So there's this other force that's really happening, and it's happening through us. And there are certain principles of self-realization, which is the words that I would use to describe the path that I've been on. This is what Yogananda describes in Autobiography of a Yogi. And it involves certain principles, such as that the soul's journey is longer than just one physical body, that we have many incarnations, and the process of our growth and development, just as we watch it evolve over the course of one lifetime that we can remember, in exactly the same way it evolves over the course of many lifetimes. And most of the world, much of the world, just takes reincarnation for granted. It's only very, actually, small minorities of the population that dispute it. But now it's become so much the way people think. I'm going to describe it as if it were an accepted fact. When I first heard about it, I didn't really know if it was true or not. I was an American raised in a Jewish family, and there was no hint of it. But as soon as it was presented to me as an idea, it's like a whole lot of unanswered questions were suddenly answered. And I started following, this was when I was 19, I just started looking at life as if this lifetime, the babyhood of the little baby that was just born, is a continuing chapter. You know how little children get to the point where they can read well enough to read chapter books? It's a big deal. Instead of a book that just goes from front to back, now they have one that has chapters. Well, our lives are chapter books. And we have a whole chapter that is contained within itself, but then we turn the page and there's another chapter that happens after it. And the principle of self-realization is very, very simple. There is an enduring individuality which is recognizably myself in all my incarnations and is cumulatively myself in all my incarnations, the same as all of us who are chronologically developed now used to be young, and we used to be children, we used to be babies. The most amazing thing to me is when I see great big men and I can just remember, you know, they must have been small enough for the mother to hold him. And now there's just this huge reality that has developed. But you can see the presence of the same individuality in there, can't you? Even though the costume has changed completely, there's an essential individuality that's recognizable. And it's not really a much farther step when you think of the difference between childhood and adulthood, or youth and old age, to think from one lifetime to another lifetime. That the body is a material thing and it wears out. But what happens to all that experience? What happens to all that learning? What happens to all those unresolved issues? I mean, we all have deeply unresolved issues. Things, the primary force that brings us back to new incarnations, Swami Kriyananda articulated as longing or regret. And if you really think about that, that's what binds our consciousness, doesn't it? We long for something, either something we used to have that we want again, something that we never had that we always wanted, or we had experiences that we feel we didn't handle as well as we could, and now we live in a stage of regret. And you can feel within yourself that those are pulsating energies, aren't they? That longing for, I mentioned that I've never had children. That was a conscious decision on my part that I'm very content with. But I know women who long to have children, but for one reason or another, it never happened for them. And in their hearts, they still have that feeling. What happens when we take off the body at death? What happens to that longing? What happens to that desire to do it over again? Well, according to the principles of self-realization, we exist actually on three levels simultaneously. We exist on the level of thought, we exist on the level of energy, and we exist on the level of the physical, the form, the material, the energetic, and the level of thought. And there's pure consciousness beyond that. And when the process of reincarnation works like this, that there, I'm sure you've heard about the concept of chakras. Many of you might be very deeply schooled in this, the concept of kundalini energy, and various other aspects of that. The chakras are a non-physical reality. They are an energy system. But they are an energy system which actually is the blueprint that manifests the physical body that we live in. And all through the course of an incarnation, actually through the course of many incarnations, but thinking of just one, every time we have experiences, every experience in life affirms a certain perception of reality, a certain commitment to what is true. For example, if I believe that my happiness depends on having, well, the question of a partner, the question of a child, the question of a home, of a job, of money, then I'm defining myself in a certain way, and I'm declaring that reality is that I will be happy if I have this, I will be unhappy if I don't have this. Now that there's so much understanding of completely other cultures and other ways of life, we're no longer an insular anywhere on this planet. We know about monks and nuns who live in seclusion with no physical possessions and no participation in this world. We know about Himalayan yogis who are way up in the snows, who live in the wintertime in a cave, and just Tibetan monks who can just sleep in the snow and generate warmth from their own body and own nothing. And their definition of reality is quite different than mine or yours. I couldn't sleep in the snow. If I tried to sleep in the snow, I would freeze. That's my belief. And I would die. But this Tibetan yogi just goes out and he sleeps in the snow. He just does it because he has a certain level of reality. Well, let's take something closer to home. Somebody does something very unkind to you. Is your perception of reality, oh, that poor soul. They would never have behaved so unkindly if they weren't terribly unhappy within themselves. I think I'll do something nice for them. Or when somebody does something unkind to you, is the first thought that comes to you, boy, am I going to get him. I heard this just horrible story of misunderstanding in that respect. An Indian woman, a friend of mine, moved from India. She's now chronologically developed as I am, but she was 24 at the time, and she was a nurse, and she was in charge of the whole department, the whole ward, whatever it was. This was her first year in America. Her birthday happens to be October 31st, Halloween, which was not a holiday that existed in India. She knew nothing about it. It's out of the Christian tradition, or the Druid tradition, actually. And so on her birthday, her colleagues presented her a birthday cake. And because it was Halloween, they presented her birthday cake that had a witch on it, just because it was Halloween. She thought they were expressing their opinion of her, right? But she was determined that it wasn't going to get to her, so she just shined it right on. And then, as she put it, she made the next year hell for all of her, the people. And it wasn't until a year or two later that she found out that it was perfectly innocent, that they didn't know. But not to her credit, her response was, well, people hurt me, I'll hurt them back. So our chakras are a spectrum of definitions of reality, from the consciousness of a Christ, who even when he was being crucified, he looked at those who were crucifying him, and he felt such compassion, really, he felt such compassion for the bad karma that they were getting for doing this thing, that he prayed, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. He was interceding that the consequences of their own wrong actions not be given to them, because he felt such compassion for them, even as he's being crucified. Now, that's the consciousness of a Christ, where reality is, we are all children of God, and these poor souls are misguided. Lord, please don't make them suffer. No thought of myself, what's happening to me, nothing. And that's a very high level. And that's a very high level in your chakras. And then everything in between, from being a person who murders and loves doing it, and sadistic and wants people to suffer, to Christ consciousness. And there's all in between. And every time we do anything in our lives, anytime we have any response to any circumstance, if circumstances change and we lament, we want them to be different. If we had something and we lose it and we feel suddenly that, I can't go on without what I had before. I can only love if these conditions are here. Or we have a deep faith in God. And even if circumstances suddenly become very difficult for us, it doesn't mean we're not grieving. But nonetheless, we may feel that God is in charge of my life, and if this is what he sends me, this is what I want to have. That doesn't mean that you're not sorrowful, but you can see that that's a different level of reality than being angry or distressed or rebellious. And all of those different vibrations are part of our self-definition, because when you think about it, the way we respond to circumstances is according to what we think is real, where happiness comes from, what causes us suffering, what will produce more happiness, what will mitigate suffering. We make decisions. Every decision is based on that happiness-suffering spectrum. one way or another. Sometimes our decisions are appallingly misguided, but it always seemed like a good idea at the time. It just seemed like a good idea, so we did it. We thought it would reduce suffering, and we thought it would increase happiness, so we did it. Right. And so what happens in the chakras are just an energy field, and vibrations of energy are there. And people who are healers, many of whom work through East-West, they can read your chakras, which is to say where most of us see the physical world with physical eyes, some people can literally see the energy world or they can feel the energy world, even as they live in physical bodies. They can feel the distribution of energy in your chakras. They can feel where it's concentrated. They can feel what the proportions are. They can feel where energy might be stuck, regret and longing that's holding us. And when our physical bodies die, that whole energy pattern is still completely intact. And that's karma. That's how karma is carried from one lifetime to the other. Because this is then the blueprint for the incarnation that comes after. Because everything is, this is an energy universe. And the matter is not, even matter itself is just an illusion. It's a field of energy. And this vibration in our chakras literally radiates magnetism and draws to us or repels what is appropriate, what matches. You know, if you're obsessed with a certain individual, you get to be born close to them or you'll meet them. If you hate someone, you may get to be born close to them or you'll meet them, because hate also has power like this. And so we progressively, over many incarnations, we essentially refine that energy pattern by the experiences that we have. And in the space of a few years of one lifetime, we can all say, I really learned a lot from that, didn't I? And you'll think of something that happened to you, and over the course of it running its course, you'll have learned something. And what we generally learn, I mean, what real progress is on the spiritual path, real progress, is an ever-expanding awareness of the potential for happiness, of the real causes of suffering, and of what is enduringly real. So if we had a tragedy when we were 15 because something we really thought we had to have, you know, didn't materialize, and then by the time we're 25 we realize we were really spared a catastrophe, we will have learned something. We will have become aware of possibilities we didn't know when we were 50. Something happens to us at 50. And we become aware of possibilities, perhaps powers within ourselves, talents within ourselves, necessary lessons in compassion. Just, you can make a long list of it. But you see, we're always moving, or at least it's best if we're always moving. Sometimes people just quit before their lives are over. Sometimes they quit when they're 20. Sometimes they quit when they're 7. You know, they just quit. They're not going to learn anything. They are going to be what they are, and they're just going to damn well stay that way no matter what happens. And they'll resist all experiences and just cling to whatever they happen to be. But ideally, we keep learning. And then we have to ask the question, you know, is what happens to us for our benefit? Or is what happened, you know, is it random? Is there a purpose? Is there a system going on here? Well, the whole system of karma, starting with the pattern in the chakras, says that we are constantly creating and making our own destiny. Now, there's a divine element in this too. We're not in complete charge. But this is the means by which we are influencing our own destiny by our responses. If we become angry and small-minded, then we start vibrating in an angry and small-minded way, and our magnetism becomes angry and small-minded, and all the things that will happen because of that will happen. I read a story in Reader's Digest a number of years ago about a woman whose daughter was murdered. And the man who killed her was caught and convicted, and he was the man who killed her. And he was in prison. And she thought, you know, this would be the end of it. You know, it's all settled. But she found herself just obsessed with anger, just consumed with anger. And she finally began to realize that she was going to die from that anger. And that it began to cross her mind that this was no way to honor her daughter. So she didn't know what else to do, so she went to the prison to visit the man who had killed her daughter, which, of course, took tremendous courage to confront him. She was hoping that something would happen. So now she sees this man. I have a friend who's been incarcerated for many years and has been in maximum security. I hope to God justice will be served in his case soon. But I've walked into maximum security at Folsom, where you're really dealing with violent criminals. But it's also neutralized by that point, because you've been through 5 airlocks and, you know, nobody has weapons and everything. So you're just in a room like in a multi-purpose room from junior high, and you're sitting at these little tables, and all of that, the men's prison, all of these men on a visitor's day, which is the only way I see it, have their families with them. And, you know, you can't conceive, you don't even want to know what brought these men into this place, but they look like you and me. You know, there's just, it's hard to hold this, these are monstrous people image, because you're just eating food out of these terrible machines and they're playing with their children, right? So this woman went, and there she was. She was confronted with this man, and there was nothing she could do with her anger. There was no place to put it. So she tried to talk to him. And of course, the end of the story is Reader's Digest vintage. It was beautiful. Brings me to tears even when I think of it. He had never been aware of the actual reality of other people's feelings until he got to know the mother of the woman he killed. It was just as simple as that. He just didn't know. He didn't know that when he took something he wanted and in the process took someone's life, that there was actually someone like him on the other side of that. An expansion of awareness on a very simple level. And she, of course, began to realize that this man was also all the brutal things that had happened to him. And they became very close. Now, this is a remarkable story of how we don't know something and then we find out something. And where we're all going is we're all going to the consciousness of a Christ. That's what self-realization is. When Jesus said, "Be ye therefore perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, and that which I do ye shall do, and greater things," he wasn't actually flattering us or just being nice. He was just saying, this is who you must become. And why must we become that? Because that is the final answer to happiness and the end of suffering, is when we understand our true relationship with all of creation, all of infinity. And anything less than that, sooner or later, is going to disappoint us. Because change is what happens. Even if we do manage to get it all finally organized just the way we want it, time will pass, won't it? It's just time will pass. And you were speaking of caring for your husband, and, you know, we were all young. I kept my favorite picture of my parents was their engagement picture when they were 24, and he was a handsome man in the army, and my mother was just dewy-eyed and delightful. And, you know, then they were 80, and she was crippled with Parkinson's, and his mind wasn't quite the same anymore. But they had been that other reality, and they loved each other deeply for 56 years. But then what happened? It went away, didn't it? Because it always does. So will we endlessly live in longing and regret? Will the pattern that we continually imprint on our chakras be one of longing and regret, where we get to come back again and try one more time to make it work just the way I want to? Or are we going to be challenged to expand into an ever greater state of awareness, not so that we'll be miserable, but so that we can finally put an end to all misery? Now, after much introspection and consideration of the facts, as I understand them, that's the point of view I take on life now. Now, the human ego says life is meant to be easy and life is meant to be pleasurable. And when you really think about it, that's the assumption that we're all working with. Life is meant to be easy. Life is meant to be pleasurable. And so what we call bad is what is not easy and is not pleasurable. Now, that works if we've already achieved our maximum potential and we just want to hunker down in it and just sit there like these clams who kind of grind themselves into the rocks, right? And then they just hang out there and food comes by and they open their mouths and then they close it. And it's not a very inspiring life, but actually when you think about it, a lot of us behave like that. We're just trying to grind our way into the rocks and we want to just sit there and then open our mouth when food comes by and close it when it goes over. And when we're dislodged from that, we feel that something really horrible has happened to us. When a little child, 5-year-old child, I'm talking about going to school, going by the school, when a 5-year-old child has to go to school, oftentimes they're a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old, I don't want to go to school, Mommy. I want to stay home with you. No, dear, you need to go to school because you're going to grow up and you'll need it. Child logic. No, I won't. I won't grow up. I'm going to live with you all the time, Mommy. Well, you need to learn to read and do numbers. No, I don't. And the child has no perspective, absolutely no perspective on its own potential, but it still, that doesn't stop it from declaring what is true. And of course, the child's declaration has no effect on what is true. Now, not so different with us. We say, I want this relationship, I want this way to live, I want this money, I want this body, whatever it might be. And we have no perspective on our own potential. I mean, this store is filled with opportunities for you to hear from people with expanded perspectives on what the perspective might be. But we have no perspective, we simply declare. Because now it's not pleasurable and now it's not easy. And I don't want to do this. I don't want to go to school. I'm going to stay here and live with you all the time, Mommy. And Mommy, in this case, what I call Divine Mother, the Spirit touches us in every possible way that a human heart can be touched. And when we think of the idealized image of feminine love, what you think of is compassion, isn't it? Compassion and unconditional acceptance. So when we're trying to personify in our own minds, you know, an aspect of Spirit, if we think of it as Divine Mother, what we're personifying is compassion and acceptance. And if we can think of the Spirit as compassionate and accepting, that makes us much more courageous in the face of it, doesn't it? And the Heavenly Father, so to speak, is also required because there's also the necessity to face the challenge. That's the masculine energy, more impersonal. I know you're afraid of doing this, honey, but you have to do it. That's what the masculine says. Whether it comes from the man or the woman doesn't matter. I know you're afraid of doing this, but you have to do it. So both aspects, the Heavenly Father and the Divine Mother, the divine male and female, are always saying to us, dear, you have no perspective. And I know you're sincere and emphatic in what you think is going to be in your best interest, but you have no perspective. And so what happens if we enter into our life experience with some expanded awareness, or at least a willingness to try, then our experience has become very different. You know, yes, this is very difficult. Yes, this is not anything that I wanted. I sometimes laugh because it's like we're born and we write a contract. This is what's going to happen. I'm going to meet this person, I'm going to marry them, they're going to love me forever, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this, and then we sign that with a flourish, and we just kind of hold it in our hand all through life, right? And when things don't go the way we think, we read it, and then we sort of shake that contract at the universe, and we don't notice that the only signature on it is ours. No one and nothing in creation promised to agree with our childish, limited perspective on our own potential. I often joke with my friends, oh, God is taking an unwelcome interest in your expansion of consciousness, isn't he? Because that is how we feel sometimes. We may know in the end it's, you know, good for us, but it's not. We're not happy to have it. And now, you know, the other aspect of our story tonight is about grief and dealing with things. We live on many levels at the same time. And a perspective such as I'm describing does not in any way separate us from our spontaneous and natural and heartfelt responses. You know, it's very possible to simultaneously be courageous and heartbroken. It's very possible to be determined and also just curled up in your bed weeping. And all things happen at the same time. The process, but what we first need to overcome, the first step to overcome, is our rebellion against what is. And when circumstances come to us in a certain way, what does it serve us to demand that they be different? I mean, first of all, we have no power. I'm a very practical person. I don't like to waste time and energy. When I see that something is inevitable, even if it breaks my heart, and often it does, then my next thought is, okay, now that we have to deal with this, how can we deal with this as gracefully and courageously as possible? And then here's the next step. I wonder what it is that I'm supposed to be learning. And that's by no means an easy question to answer, and often it's a very, very difficult thing to accept. Sometimes we don't even know what we're trying to learn. I recently have had some experiences, and I've had to discern the difference between actually being happy, meaning really happy and joyful in my heart, and merely being pleased by my circumstances. I'm a generally happy person, and I'm also I move through the world. I'm not helpless in the world. And so therefore, I can generally sort of make my world match what the image that I have in my mind. I can conceive of things and manifest them. By no means am I superior in this respect, but I'm not helpless. So a great deal of my life is exactly the way I want it to be. And so therefore, I think that I'm happy. But then what happens when things happen that are not at all what I wanted? Oh, where is that happiness? Oh, I wasn't really happy. I was just pleased, wasn't I? Just pleased, not displeased, just pleased. But just being happy because you're pleased, the only word I can use for that is it's very dangerous. Because nothing ever stays the same. So where we have to find is we have to find another basis for our happiness. Now, don't misunderstand me. That doesn't mean you turn up your nose at all the good things that come and you have the good fortune to have great friends and a marvelous partner and a wonderful home and many things that you love. And you don't just... People think that to be non-attached is actually to close your heart. That's not at all true. The people who love the most completely are the people who are the least dependent on what they love for their happiness because they have nothing to lose. See, most of us love with some degree of fear or some degree of expectation of response. And therefore, we are always vulnerable. But if what we really love, and this is where the spiritual life becomes essential, if what we really love is the presence of God in our lives, the power of the Spirit guiding us, the presence of Divine Mother taking us by the hand and leading us through this chapter book of many incarnations and bringing to us exactly what we need at the time we need it, no matter how unpleasant and difficult it might be. And so what we love is the adventure of expanding consciousness. And even if we really don't like, intensely don't like, the lesson that's been given to us at the moment, because it involves death and dislocation and loss on so many different levels, we can still find happiness in our inner relationship with that higher power that is right with us, taking us through. And then you end up existing on all these levels at the same time. You know, the part of you that is, you're not afraid to be grief-stricken over this, because simultaneously, or I would say under it, there's this awareness that God is taking me where he wants to go. And that comfort is enduring, you see. Even when this life ends and you go on to the next one, that's there. That's always there. There was a story, a remarkable story, about a woman, one of those death and return stories. I can't, unfortunately, remember the name of the book. But she actually suicided. She tried to kill herself and did not succeed. But as soon as she crossed out of her body and went into the other world, she went into a very, a place of deep despondency, where she saw many other individuals who had seemingly, her perception was that they had also suicided. And she said, judging from the clothes they were wearing, as it looked to her, it looked like some of them had been there a really long time. And they were just, they had, you know, put forward this great life-negating energy, and they just were in a state of negation. Now, if you have friends or loved ones who have killed themselves, all karma can be worked out, and nothing is forever. But she was there in that place, and everybody was looking down like this. And she happened to glance up, and she saw that there were legions of angels whose job it was to try to bring these souls back into the light. And because she looked up, she saw, and she was able to go right into that light, and then she was brought back into her body. Now, think about that, because whenever we allow ourselves to become discouraged or depressed or overcome with grief, which happens to everyone, what is it that is finally going to pull us out of it? It's going to be the recognition that even no matter how dark it is, there's always a force of light that's trying to get our attention. If only, as you were saying, now that I've had this experience, I feel like I really have something to give. I certainly have felt that in my life. Just now that I've had this experience, I understand something I never understood before. And so much good can be done. And I would never have been able, that good would never have happened if I hadn't had this experience. In the midst of having it, it's small comfort, but there's always a little piece of your awareness that says, everything is happening for a reason and this is taking me somewhere. So even as I weep, where is this taking me? Because that, you see, is the one thing that's always with you, as I was saying. Everything else comes and goes, but that the divine is giving you just what you need and exactly what you need. Mother Teresa of Calcutta said, God never gives me more than I can handle, but sometimes I wish he didn't trust me so much. Which is, it's a dilemma that one faces. What makes you think, Lord, that I can handle this when I don't feel that I can? You know, but if it's come to me, I must be able to, no matter what. Now, let me think, there was another thought behind that. There's another metaphysical, and I've been talking devotionally because that's really how I live. But there's a metaphysical side to this, which is also very interesting, because when I'm talking about the karma being deposited, being stored in the chakras and the vibrations, everything that we, every time we commit ourselves by thought, by action, by attitude, to a reality other than Christ consciousness, we are planting within ourselves the necessity to learn a lesson, because we're all on this, like rivers flowing to the sea. I mean, as soon as water emerges from the earth, it heads for the ocean. As soon as we are manifested from the divine, we are heading back to the ocean of spirit. And every time we affirm a reality that is less than our ultimate divine potential, we are establishing something that we don't know that we're going to have to learn. Longing and regret, there it is. Every time, any response. So what that is, that's karma. Karma is unlearned lessons. So in future incarnations, that karma will come, will find an opportunity to express itself, and it will bring to us whatever is coming to us now. Karma is always exactly right. That is very, very tough teaching. Very tough. I can say it easily, it is a very tough teaching. that nothing comes to us that isn't exactly appropriate because of energy we ourselves put out in the past that establish an unlearned lesson that we now have the opportunity to learn. I mean, all our good karma is the same, but you know, we're just, it's something is happening. But there's a perfect, and this is where the word metaphysics comes in. You know, it's a perfectly balanced system. There's not some arbitrary person just passing out the karma like this. It's the result of the magnetic field that we ourselves are putting out, interacting with the magnetic fields of the universe, coming together in exactly the way it needs to come together. So no karma ever rises to expression that isn't drawn out by what you want to say, our soul readiness to have it happen. So this is the metaphysical explanation of why God never gives you a test greater than you can handle. If you're not ready to handle it, the karma remains hidden until you have the strength to handle it. But it will push us right to the edge. And then we just have to pull everything together that we can have. And we stay in these bodies, to go to the question of death again for just a moment. We stay in these bodies, our body, whatever it is, as long as it serves its true purpose. And its true purpose is not pleasure and ease. Its true purpose is to be a vehicle for the destiny of the soul in order to be able to fulfill itself. We're born for divine things. And we'll stay in this body as long as it's helping us. And we never die 1 second before we should. And even if you die young or die suddenly or seemingly with unfinished business, there's something that required that body was simply done. That personality, those circumstances, it doesn't mean, you know, that you're failed or didn't fail. It's just you're finished. That I've used it for all that it's can be used for. Swami Kriyananda put it interestingly when he was talking about relation of parents and their children. He said, parents create the physical vehicle for the individual spirit, for the soul, to express its destiny. But the parents create neither the soul nor its destiny. That is pre-existing, and it merely enters into that particular womb, that particular body, those particular circumstances, to express its destiny. And we come together with people that we love because our souls are going to need a certain experience. And that experience will last just as long as it needs to last. It was very interesting. My mother died 2 years before my father. And they were very attached to each other. And for then my father died. And I have a brother and a sister. And we're all sensitives. During the 2 years that my father was still in this world and my mother was in the other world, every time I would think about my mother, it was very unsettling to me. And I took care of her and I felt that I had been honorable. She'd been ill with Parkinson's and it was a tough ending. But still there was just this, I couldn't think of her very much because she felt unsettled to me. The morning after my father died, when I thought about my mother, it was all just peace, like this. And interestingly, my sister and my brother and I were talking at my father's funeral, and we all three had exactly the same experience. We just never told each other because none of us knew what to do with it. We just were a little dismayed. You know, just it wasn't that she was suffering. She just seemed unsettled. But as soon as my father was out of the body and in the astral world with her, she was fine. You know, it's just like she needed him in some way. I don't understand that world enough to know how to say, but I thought it was so touching in a certain way. You know, these are divine gifts to us. It's given to us. It's not like my father needed a little break, I think. He went a little, not like into full Alzheimer's, but he just took a mental holiday the last few years of his life. He just needed a vacation. It wasn't at all distressing to me because he just needed a vacation. He just carried too much for too long, and he just was done. And he became very sweet, very happy, and he just, the sharp Virgo mind that was always doing things just stopped. And he just took a little holiday before he had to go on and do what he had to do. You know, it's, everything happens just as it's meant to happen. Does that make sense? Now, questions, comments? Yeah. No, it's a very, very good question. I have a certain understanding of this, but not because I visit those realms. I sort of remember them, and I also have discussed this at great length with Swami Kriyananda, who I believe actually could see. So it's a combination of intuition, what I've learned, and what I believe to be true, and what Yogananda says. Our connection with people, I mean, our true love connection, souls, we develop soul relationships that last through eternity. So not everyone that we encounter is as deeply connected to us, but we have many deep connections. And love is an enduring reality. The form that that love takes is ever-changing. So someone who is your husband now may be your son later, or your boss, or your next-door neighbor. And the form constantly changes because people die and different things happen. Yogananda commented rather wryly that a woman will grieve the loss of her baby if the baby dies young, and that same soul will be born next door and the mother won't have the same relationship at all. And if the mother was truly sensitive, she would. But if the relationship was based on the form, this is my child, then she won't be able to recognize when that same spirit is there. But part of what happens as our capacity to love becomes more and more Christ-like, Christ consciousness more and more united with infinity, then we recognize that the form that we're acting out is not really the definition of our loving each other. Someone is a husband or a wife, maybe they even get divorced, but that love is still there and that soul connection is still there, but the form may have been broken. Or your little darling little baby boy becomes a big hulking guy who isn't as interested in you as he was. But nonetheless, the love is still there. So what happens to us in the astral world is that the forms are all different, because form in the astral world is very fluid. It's not, the material body is fixed. You can only have one of them and it's always the same. In the astral world, you're moving with energy and it shifts much more. So Yogananda writes in a chapter in Autobiography of a Yogi, which is a very, very good book. There's a chapter called The Resurrection of Sri Yukteswar, and it's a lot about the astral world. You get to the astral world and you meet everybody. And you meet all your husbands, or many of your husbands, and your wives and your children. And he says, at first it's a little confusing, because if we're attached to the exclusive rigidity of form, and that form is gone, but we still have the heart feeling, we have to expand our awareness and realize, oh, it was just that spirit wearing that body. But it was really the spirit that I was attached to the whole time. The spirit can be in many places at the same time. The ego might not be aware of it, but the spirit. So that's why, because people die, go into the tunnel of light, and then they see, you know, Grandma Rose there. And you think, well, Grandma Rose has been dead for 35 years, you know, hasn't she gone on? But nonetheless, an aspect of her spirit will take that form so you can connect. Because there's our conscious level and then there's our superconscious. And our superconscious is capable of doing much more than our conscious mind knows. And it gets a little vague in my capacity to explain it. But that's how I understand it to be. So that which is the essence of this man that you loved, you will of course meet him again if your relationship was based on more than the physical. If there was more to your connection than just two physical bodies, then without those bodies you will still have that connection. But he may appear to you in the form that you recognize in order for you to do that. So whether or not you've reincarnated is really not an issue, because whatever connects you will connect you. If he's reincarnated, it may inhibit the next form that your relationship could take. How long people stay in the astral world is quite variable. Some people, if you understand that consciousness can exist outside of the brain and outside of the physical body, you can move consciously into the non-physical world. People who, as Yogananda put it, who believe that consciousness is material and that consciousness is dependent on the brain, he said, when the brain dies, they feel obligated to go unconscious. That's how he put it. But if you've meditated or had a more refined sense of reality or a deeper relationship with God, you recognize in yourself that I have dimensions that are not dependent on my physical being. So even when your brain begins to die, you can move into that non-physical realm. But some people, Yogananda said, never wake up at all in the astral world. They just can't conceive of reality without a physical body. And he said, it's just, as he put it, a gray dream to them. And they don't really become conscious again until they have another physical body, until they're a baby again. And then often, they just kind of try to take up where they left off. The same music, the same interests. You know, you see babies dancing, because the internet gives us all these things. You see little tiny babies doing very sensual dancing to very harsh, not baby-like stuff. And you can just see that this soul, just that's where they were when they died, and they just, as soon as they can, they just get right back to it. Right? Like that. Or they are very sensitive, and they come back in, they bring that sensitivity in.
If they're in the
gray state.
Gray state,
uh-huh.
Who makes it? Have to be a commitment on their part as well to participate?
It's the vibration of your chakras, you see. You have astral karma, which is, for example, in the astral world, everything is more beautiful, and you can create beauty just with your thoughts, and you can live in kind of a paradisical way, and you can play music and create art and make great scientific discoveries. And if you have a longing in your spirit for a very refined experience that is not dependent on the physical body, then you have more astral karma, because you will relate to that world and you will be able to expand your awareness by having those experiences. And you may also be very refined in that way, but you realize that being in the astral world is like being on the island of Kauai, and it's great for a while, but sooner or later I've got to come back and get back to work. So you can be very advanced spiritually, but spend very little time in the astral world because you want to get your karma worked out. So and so it's not like anybody's doing it to you. It's like the vibrations themselves compel these things to happen. And there are people who write about it, and you are conscious, and you have guardian angels, but it's not like a psychology session or something. Well, Mabel, you know, what do you want to do this time? It happens on a much more energy flow kind of way. But it's your decision in this sense. It's the result of whatever you... It's nothing happens when you die. Absolutely nothing happens, and you do not change. You do not suddenly become a good or a bad person. You are exactly who you were. Just when I go home tonight, I'm going to take off this dress, and I'm going to put on my comfy cotton nightgown. But I'm going to look a little different. But inside, I'm just exactly the same person. Just changing my dress is not going to change me. So just taking off your body and going to the astral world does not change your consciousness. It just gives you an opportunity to express it differently. Just as if, I love tropical islands, we went off to Bora Bora, you know, and suddenly in Bora Bora we wear flowers in our hair and we go barefoot and we just behave differently because the atmosphere allows us to behave differently. And we can't do that in Silicon Valley in the same way. But it's perfectly natural there to be behaving like that. So we go to the astral world, but we're still ourselves. We haven't become any better or worse. We're just another dimension. And how long we stay? And you do work from there too. You help each other, and you help other beings who are incarnated on the planet. Yes. That's a very, very high level of evolution. Jesus put it, Jesus was talking about karma when he said, you were all born with sin, but I was born without sin. What that means is he had no unlearned lessons. He understood eternity, he understood suffering, he understood happiness. There was nothing he had to learn. All of us have misunderstandings. And so we have to keep having experiences until we actually get it completely right, until our spontaneous response.
But I mean, eventually, don't some people
yes.
get that?
Yes. It's called an avatar. Avatar has many meanings these days. Unfortunately, it's been corrupted in horrible ways. But the true meaning of the word avatar is a descent from spirit completely and only for the sake of helping others. No karma. Swami Kriyananda was not an avatar, but he was a free soul. He was a Jivan Mukta, which means that he allowed a certain amount of karma to continue because it gave him a reason to keep coming back. But he was no longer identified with anything that happened. He was completely impersonal. Kriyananda was, as he put it, an event that he was responsible for, but he didn't accrue karma because he didn't identify with the experiences that he had. Whereas when things happen to me, I think they happen to me. I don't just see myself as a bubble in the ocean being batted about by the other bubbles. I'm inside the bubble and I feel it. And yes, but people, it's progressive. I mean, you see, some people are very, very, you see that they're bound in countless ways. And other people move very freely through life. And so it's just a matter of degree. And when you see it in any degree, you ask yourself the question, well, is there any limit to how free you can become? And according to all the ancient true traditions, no, there is no limit. You become infinite. And that's it. Yes. Yes. There is such a thing as group karma, but you see, partly your soul chooses to incarnate with the group that will have the group karma that will cause it. But you would not be in that body. I was raised in a Jewish family, as I mentioned, and the Jews have some fairly hairy karma that happens to them on a regular basis. But the same. Some Jewish traditions say there is such a thing as a Jewish soul. I do not accept that as a valid metaphysics. But when you're in the astral world and you need to be, let's say, for example, and this is how I finally figured out myself, I wanted to be in an intensely intellectual milieu in which intellect was highly valued because that was to a distortion on my part, a distorted value on my part, but I was intensely drawn to that. And I needed also to be part of a persecuted minority. I just needed to have a little bit of persecuted minority experience. So I just looked around and found a nice Jewish family in America. And I got to be a mildly persecuted minority, very mildly, intensely intellectual, and arrogant as hell. Which I've had to work through over all these years. And I sort of, it just suited me. And this, being a refugee, see, you look at it. This is where it gets confusing. You look at it, you think, oh, what a terrible thing. But this is also on the other side of it. It's a remarkable opportunity for people to be incredibly courageous, terrifically detached, marvelously creative, utterly compassionate. I mean, you can become magnificent through this experience, or you can become crushed. And that's when I was part of a Jewish Christian conversation. My Episcopal priest friend thought it would be fun to bring a Jewish yogi to a Jewish Christian meeting, so he brought me. We were reading these various things, and it was the Jews were talking about the Holocaust, because the Jews often talk about the Holocaust. It's a big experience. And there was this one rabbi who had written, he wasn't in the room, it was just things we were reading, and he said those years were the shining hour of the Jewish people, because we had the opportunity to prove to ourselves and to the world that there is only one reality, and that reality is God. Now that is an amazing response, isn't it? And only a handful of people were able to have it. But those who were able to have it, think what they learned. See, the opportunity is always there. You can go any direction at all. Experiences are always neutral. And experiences are always exactly tailored for you to have the opportunity to progress in the ways that you need to progress. That woman whose daughter was murdered, she was simply hating and was angry. And she had the awareness to realize this is not the right response to this experience. And then instead turned it into really quite a remarkable opportunity for growth. So, you know, was it a tragedy? Was it a blessing? You get very confused when you start thinking of it like that. And the people who are instigating that suffering are also in a very difficult learning curve, because what do you think is going to happen to someone who instigates that kind of suffering? They're going to have to find out what it feels like, aren't they? Because how else will you understand what you've done? You put the energy out, where is it going to go? Which is a very scary thought when you think about the people who are suffering, because you don't want to think that they're the ones who caused this. So it's very challenging. The whole law of karma is very, 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 very challenging. But when you can finally really relax into it, it's remarkably liberating on every level. Liberating even in the sense of not becoming so agitated by the nightly news. Because you just realize all these souls are just working it out. And what else would we be doing here?
So is there an addition to it?
There's a book called Karma and Reincarnation. I actually looked for it on the shelf. It's not out here right now, but you can go to the desk and ask them to get it for you. The Wisdom of Yogananda series. It's called Karma and Reincarnation. It's also a lot about death. There's another book called How to Be a Channel, which is by Swami Kriyananda, which I believe is out of print, but if you go on Amazon, you can always pick up copies. How to Be a True Channel. The book, you just don't think from the title what it is, but it's all about death in the astral world. It's very interesting. About karma otherwise. Mostly it's... I have a YouTube channel. My personal website is called Asha Joy. And if you go to Asha Joy, it'll take you to the YouTube channel, and I have a lot of really good classes on karma. Especially, I have to sort of explain all of this. I was in New Zealand, and I did a lot of classes for people who are very bright and very interested, but very new. So I did very comprehensive classes on many basic subjects, including karma and reincarnation. So if you get to the YouTube channel, it says New Zealand Tour, click on that, if you're just starting. That's really my own classes are actually the best that I can recommend. I wish there were others, but I'm just going to have to do that. There's nothing else I can say. Yes.
My grandmother died a week ago. Uh-huh. And she was a woman of great faith.
Uh-huh.
And yet, a week before, you know, that she was ready. And that,
yeah,
you know, she would be grateful.
It's very common for people at the end, even people of great faith who die very joyously and peacefully, when they really see what's coming, whatever's left in you. And even if you've... There's an interesting story, an autobiography of a yogi, where one master sends a message to the other saying that, you know, the sands of time of your life are running out. And the master himself suddenly became very grave, as they describe it, and for several hours was very silent. And then came again. Because this is, you're really going to have to sever all your attachments. You're really going to lose the familiarity of where you are. You're really going to have to go through the process of dying, which is a little scary in itself. You know, my heart stops, my breath stops, what will it feel like? Even though we've done it countless times, there's still this anxiety. There also sometimes, and this is an argument against euthanasia, often sometimes it's like everything comes to a head, and whatever last lingering, it's the final exam, whatever last lingering unresolved issues there may be. You know, a person can have great faith, but there may still also be fear and doubt, you know. And so all of it has to be faced at the very end. And almost everyone, they say, just has those moments of just, this is really it, this is not a rehearsal anymore. And anybody who works with hospice or with dying people tells you to anticipate that and just hold on. Also, it's sort of like this last, this is the way Stephen Levine described it. This just sort of, you're losing control of your body, and we are very accustomed to solving the problems of our consciousness. If you feel uncomfortable in your mind, you'll often do something through your body. You know, you'll just be lying in bed and you'll be having thoughts that are bothering you. So you'll get up and you'll clean the house or you just move yourself. But in the very end, you can't move your body anymore. So you often have no way to resolve that agitation in the consciousness. You have to solve the problem of consciousness on the level of consciousness. And depending how well trained you are doing that, even people of great faith may not really have been trained in concentration and meditation. And so they're just the normal agitations that you would usually just dissipate physically, just all concentrate like that. But often that the intensity of that is also what causes you to break through, and that you really come through to something higher and freer. There's also, apparently, my doctor friend told me, a certain physiological response. So sometimes when people who are even unconscious, they'll still be agitated. But he says it's not them anymore. It's just the body sort of sorting itself out. That the soul is rather separated from the body at that last time. And so unless the person is talking and telling you, you might be perceiving agitation that might not actually involve the person. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you for your beautiful teaching.
I'm glad you enjoy.
I learned so much from this experience of learning the lessons, finding the peace behind all this.
You know, it's very often that people will wait until everyone's out of the room before they die. I've had so many people feel so terrible. I just went out for a moment and that's when my mother died. But she had to, because she couldn't leave you. They're changing their whole self-definition. And when you're there in front of them, it's very difficult for them to change their self-definition. So they very often have to wait until you're not in the room. They will die in that 5-minute window when you walked away. Because they have to. They can't do it otherwise. Or they need that freedom. And then, they're out of the body, and then they'll hang around, just like you're saying. You'll have dreams and experiences, sometimes, not always. But just like that, he goes around and says goodbye. Because you're not there. You were in the cab, so he had to talk to you in the cab. And people who have the death and return experiences tell us how easy this is to do. Once you're out of your body, you have these connections. And you can just go to where those connections are. I dreamt about my mother. My mother had been sick for so long, even after she died, she didn't know, I had an experience of her I believe was true. She just didn't know she was dead, and she didn't know she was healthy. You know, she was in the astral hospital, which I understand there really is such a thing, to help people understand what's happened to them. Because she died, even though she was ill, she died suddenly. She didn't die slowly. She just had a seizure, and then she was gone. And my mother was very distrustful of a lot of people, and she trusted me to do things, but she didn't trust anyone else. She, in this dream, she's sitting on the side of the bed, and she's still rather hunched over as she got toward the end, and she's looking around, and I knew there were other people, but I couldn't see them, other beings. She calls me over, she has me sit down right next to her, and she starts telling me all the things that she wants me to take, this is a dream, that she wants me to take care of for her. I said, Mom, I think there's a lot of people here who can help you. I don't think so, she said like that. And then in the dream I said, you know what, Mom? I really think they can take care of you. So I just backed away and just left her. And then I dreamt about her. I'll tell you three. There were three, and I know they were true. The next one I dreamt, my father was still living, and I saw her, she was young. And she looked like her engagement picture. And she came to see my father. And my father was old, and they went into their room and they shut the door. And then after a few minutes, I hear her calling me, and she sounds very distressed. And I go in, and she's aging right in front of us like this. And I said to her, it's too soon. This is all in the dream. I said, it's too soon for you to be here, because she hadn't broken the identification. And so she was still so identified with being his wife and old and ill, that she sort of, as soon as she was there, she began to take that on. I mean, think about that. That happens. You go visit your parents as an adult and you start behaving like a child, right? So I sort of grabbed her and I pushed her out of the room and I said, it's too soon. Go, 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 like this. And then the last dream I had of her, It was before my father died, or maybe it was after my father died. I think it was after. And she was just standing at a window, and she just looked radiantly beautiful. And she just looked at me, and she smiled, and then it was done, and I've never dreamt of her since. But, you know, it's a progression even on that side of it. And all those things, or all of that, is really the truth.
Yeah. So,
understandable. But you have to respect. You have to respect that every single person is going to operate according to the karmic flow that's theirs. When my parents first began to be ill, especially when my mother was ill, I ran around like crazy trying to make their lives work. And I finally, and this is a very important point, and then I'll stop for the night. I finally realized that what they were experiencing was their karma. Now, I mean, you would think after all these years I would have known this, but it was their karma in this sense. They had gotten to the point that they had gotten step by step over, in their case, 80 years. So to them, it was no radical departure. It was just the next step. And it was exactly the right step that they needed for what they needed to learn. It was not easy and pleasant for me, but it was exactly appropriate for them. And what I kept trying to do was counteract their karma with my incredible energy and executive ability to run everybody's life. And oddly, they didn't appreciate that. So when I finally realized that, one, that I was not respecting them at all, I was imagining that I'm the only person on the planet who can handle their own karma. Whoa, maybe they can handle their life just like I can handle mine in their way. And instead, I tried to tune into what it was like for them and where they wanted to take it. And I started trying to help them according to their flow of energy instead of according to mine. And all of a sudden, we got on beautifully. And, you know, a lot of the things that my mother wanted to do, or especially, they just seemed loopy to me. But they didn't seem loopy to her. You know, we're going to buy new living room furniture, or we're going to go out and do this. But it was what she wanted. And why would I be always arguing with her? You know, it was just she had to finish in the way she had to finish, and I just helped her. And I learned bazillions of things from that experience. But just because you think it's unpleasant, it is unpleasant, but it's what they have to do. My mother had Parkinson's, and she fought that disease like crazy, right to the end. Absolutely. And it was annoying because she was always combating it. But she said at one point, "This has been the making of me." She was right. She'd been rather willful and a bit spoiled, and she became very strong. She became a much better person. She said, "I hate to admit it." And it was tough on all of us, but she was doing exactly what she needed to do. So you have to tune in and let them have it. And even if they're making a mistake, you just stay their friends. A mistake in the sense of, well, there's more you could get from this than you're getting. But, you know, nobody learns from being told anything. Just look at yourself. There's a clue, right? All right, great souls. I think I'll call it a night. Thank you. If you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I think we'll make this the formal ending. This was recorded, and if you go to Asha Joy and then to the YouTube channel, it won't be on there, but go to Asha Joy and go to the classes, because it's not a video. But if you just start with that website and you'll find all this stuff. I don't know when, but it'll be up there pretty soon. Okay. Thank you. Oh, certainly. Very, very interesting. Nice to be here. When the bubble merges back into the sea, the sea is composed of countless bubbles. Each of those bubbles of individuality can always be re-expressed as an individual. That's why people today can have a vision of Christ, and it's really a vision of Christ. It's not just a projection of their own mind. It's actually that individuality that lived as Christ actually re-manifests and comes to them, because this world is very different than it seems. So nothing is ever destroyed or lost. It never ends. Form changes, But when you have mastery over the material world, which a Christ or a master does, then they can remanifest in any form they wish. And even the soul can do that remanifesting, not with the same conscious control that a master can do, in order to meet your granddaughter. Even though you may actually be living somewhere else by that point, you can still meet your granddaughter so your granddaughter can have that experience. Because that's the super conscious level, which is different than the conscious level we live on. Did that make sense? Was that the whole answer?
It does. So where is Christ? Where are they? Where are they and what are they doing?
Gee, beats me. If I knew, I'd probably be with them. Let me think how to say that. See, the question is asked in the context of time and space. And we're talking about a consciousness that exists outside of the world of... I mean, I have to put this...
Are they okay.
No, but I'll give you a picture. Just a second. I need to put this away because I need both my hands. So give me just a second. I'll put the mic back on. Okay. If you think of a bicycle wheel, and all the spokes lead into the center... Past, present, future are all arrayed out on the edge of this bicycle wheel. And they appear to happen sequentially, like this. Most people are identified with them their incarnation at one speck on the edge of that bicycle wheel. And by definition, the more you are on the rim and the more identified you are, the smaller your perspective of the whole wheel. That's why some people have no idea why things happen to them, because they can't even... analyze the past, and they have no idea why tomorrow was such a bummer. They didn't realize that if they behaved that way today, that was inevitably going to happen. I mean, really, people are just amazing in what they don't see. Eternity, Christ consciousness, is like the hub of that wheel at the very center. And as we begin to expand our awareness, by definition, to expand your awareness is to identify with more than the narrowest, tiny possible definition of yourself. So what you're doing is you're moving from that tight edge down the spoke, so to speak, that's going to lead you to the center. And as soon as you're an inch from the edge, you have a perspective like this. You can begin to understand the past. You can begin to anticipate the future. You can get some mastery over your life. When you move all the way to the center here, you're still connected by that spoke to this edge. That's where Swami Kriyananda lived. He was still connected to this spoke, and he still sent energy from there. But when you're standing in the center, you're equidistant from past, present, and future, aren't you? You're equidistant from all of creation. You're not closer or farther away from any part of it. You're in relation to all of the incarnations you've ever had. And you can see them and you can project energy to all of them because you're at the origin point. Now, all of us are manifestations of the infinite. And we don't become more of that. We realize, that's where self-realization comes from. We realize what we actually are. A self-realized master consciously lives in the center and projects the energy wherever it needs to be projected. Okay? Now, what that actually is there, I don't know. Swami Kriyananda described when he was a child, he sort of lived more in the astral world, and when he would, this is his earliest memories, when he would fall asleep at night, he would see a great light at the spiritual eye. I mean, he was a baby. I mean, and then he would stare into that light, and then that light would overtake him, and he would merge into that light, and that's what he would do when he went to sleep. He thought everyone did that. He did not know that was unusual. Gradually, as he got older, like 8 or 9, various things happened, and he pulled back a little bit from that and had to go through other experiences. When he meets Yogananda at the age of 22 and learns to meditate and is able to then consciously go back into the superconscious state, these are his Swami's words, I went back exactly to where I had been as a child, and no time had passed. It was the same moment, because time is part of the wheel, but the eternal now is part of the center. So he'd gotten identified, he went right back, and he was right back. It was all equidistant. Does that help? There is one. Carmen reincarnation.
Like two more up there.
Okay.
In the front.
Okay, Karma and Reincarnation. Very good book, highly recommended. Okay. So, that's it? That was a good question. Thank you for asking that. Yeah.